supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We begin today's show with a disclaimer. You're only as young as you feel.
I'm 61. I think I feel I'm 61.
I'm 62, but the mind is starting to go. But I feel like 40.
I'm 65. I feel about 48-ish.
I'm 56 in chronological age. I guess, like most men, I'm probably about 16 inside.
I feel like in here is about 22 and I'm 67.
And we probably feel like we're in our 60s and still fresh in.
Maybe 70s. I'm 73 and I feel about 33.
63 and I feel like, probably about 42.
Well, I am 68, but I feel more like about 38, but I may look like 88.
So, there you have it. Men and women who feel much younger than they are, and they certainly appear to be enjoying their so-called autumn years. Note the tones in their voices. Well, if you're not familiar with the term, here's what one of my guests have to say about it. He says, it's a time in the life cycle when we take a look at new opportunities, possibilities, challenges, and dilemmas that emerge as a result of a longer and hopefully healthier life. And as we head towards this phase in life, he says, one thing is clear. We need a new, more balanced story of aging to guide us into the decades ahead. This story must embody hard truths, buffer us from dread, and remind us to laugh and to play. These wonderful insights come from our two guests, Gerald Shapiro and Louis Casalino. They're both with me here today to talk about the autumn years, a rather new stage of development for a diverse boomer generation that's living longer and living differently than our parents ever did. Gerald Shapiro is a professor and chair of the Department of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University. He's the author of Finding Meaning, Facing Fears in the Autumn Years, and he joins us by phone. Jerry, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Louis Casalino is a professor of psychology at the Graduate School of Education and Psychology at Pepperdine University. His books include The Healthy Aging Brain, Sustaining Attachment, and Attaining Wisdom. And he's also on the phone. Lou, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And of course, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I have a feeling some of our guests may have some expertise with the autumn years. Well, gentlemen, there's a lot of people in this category of autumn years. I'm amazed every month I get my AARP magazine and there's somebody else pictured on the front cover who just shocks me. People like Tom Hanks, Bill Gates, Maria Shriver, of course, Hillary and Bill Clinton. I mean, these are all my cohorts now. Jerry, your book is called Finding Meaning, Facing Fears in the Autumn Years. So you're about 70 and
right.
In the autumn years of your life. So tell us the fears you have to face.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. The whole idea is that there are basic existential fears we all have to deal with, mortality, loss, and so forth. And the whole issue is not to avoid them. It's crucial to start looking at them. So, you know, mortality would be the big one, right? The great unknown. But facing the fears of the unknown becomes the most crucial aspect of dealing with this age period.
So facing fears, I mean, that's you know, a term that gets bandied about. You know, we had, I just blocked on his name, the father of existential psychology out there in Stanford. Irv Yalom, thank you.
Oh, yeah, Irv,
thank
sure.
you, Jennifer. Anyway, his most recent book is called Staring at the Sun.
Right.
You know, that facing your own death, you can't do it. I mean, just seconds at a time, if that.
But Viktor Frankl also noted in Man's Search for Meaning, that wonderful, wonderful book that was written in the around 1960, Frankl said that without awareness of death, we can't make life meaningful.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the whole basis of existential psychology. Jerry, you work full-time. Tell us why you do it, and do you have a vision for the future? Do you have, like, a five-year plan?
I have a five-year plan, a 10-year plan, and a 200-year plan. I figure if I'm going to get all my projects done that I've already started, I have to live to be 218.
Okay.
But I am working full-time, and I work full-time because I just love what I do. It's creative every day. It's fun. For me, being in the classroom is ecstatic. And so that's what I do.
So what's your five-year plan?
The five-year plan is to taper down on that and get more involved in some creative things that I left behind when I was younger. I used to play a lot of music. I want to get back to that. I was very much a photographer. I want to get back to that. I want to try some new things that just haven't done before.
Hmm. So here's the question, and I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, but here's the question so many people struggle with. You're doing what you do now, full-time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got things that you'd love to do and get back to.
Mm-hmm.
What's the tipping point there, Jerry? When do you decide? How do you decide?
Yeah, well, that's the individual question, right? That's the big individual question. I think that's not an answer for everybody. I think for me, and I can respond for me, and
yeah.
I can also say what people in the survey said, but for me, a lot of the answer is I'm very fortunate that in a university you can taper down. You can go on phased retirement, so I can go half-time for 5 years, which I plan to do. I ended up as chair again this year, which was kind of going the opposite direction. But, you know, I figure I'm going to taper down and start adding other things. Of course, the danger is with everyone in retirement is that their lives seem full without adding anything.
Exactly. Exactly. Lou, you come at this issue from a different perspective. I found the title of your book really intriguing. Everybody talks about a healthy brain, but you've added things like social connection and wisdom in the same sentence as brain. So what's that connection?
Well, about 5 or 6 years ago, when I was approached to write a book on aging, I did what a lot of people do when they panic or they're anxious. I went shopping, and I bought as many books as I could find on aging. And what I found was most of them were very much focused on they had three things. I mean, pretty much exercise. You had exercise, you had to eat right, and you had to be intellectually challenged. And that was pretty much, I would say, 99% of what was contained in the 100 or so books I reviewed before I started working on my own. And my previous work has been very much in the social neurosciences and framing human life and now aging in the context of social evolution. So I started looking at, you know, how the brain evolved and how the brain evolved to stay healthy. And as a social organ, the brain is especially stimulated by connectivity. And what I discovered in my research, or at least what I made up based on what I found, was that, you know, aging is very complex, and it's tied to our social evolution. And so there are different roles that we play at different points in our lives, depending on our contribution to the tribe.
So, and say more about that connectivity and what that looks like and what that does to a brain as it ages.
Right. Well, the there are many things that stay the same about brains as they age, and one thing is that they need stimulation, they need arousal, metabolic health, and the biochemistry of attachment and bonding stimulates the brain in a way that supports and enhances neuroplasticity. And so the underlying biochemistry related to things like oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin all serve to regulate arousal, decrease stress hormones, and keep the brain as a healthy organ. And in thinking in terms of in terms of attachment, any grandparent who has fallen in love with their grandchild is evidence for the fact that the attachment circuitry remains plastic throughout life. And, for different reasons, depending on our stage of development. For an adolescent, you have to, be crazy with your friends about Justin Bieber and follow him around. And as you get older, you mate and you have your family. And then as you get older, you contribute to your tribe and to the raising of your grandchildren. And so wired into the brain is the social connectivity and the need to continue to contribute in a meaningful way to the well-being of other people.
That was Lou Cozzolino talking about some of his work, his research in his book, The Healthy Aging Brain. That's what we're talking about with Lou and Jerry Shapiro here. We're talking about not just the aging brain, we're talking about the autumn years. What life is like? What are the opportunities? What are the challenges? How our lives are so different than our parents. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What's your experience as you approach or live in your autumn years? Please call early in the show. We're going to go to the phones in a few minutes, and I have a feeling we're going to be backed up. Lou, back to you. One of the things that intrigue me is you see parallels between the aging brain and the adolescent brain in terms of attachment and belonging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the dogmas in neuroscience that I was trained in was, and probably this was true in psychoanalytic theory as well, is that the brain doesn't change much after 6 or 7, 8 years old. It gets bigger, we learn more, but fundamentally the brain is pretty much the same structure. And the work at NIMH from Jay Geed and his colleagues demonstrated that during adolescence there's considerable, restructuring of the frontal lobe and hierarchical networks. And as that dogma was crashing as I was reading Jay's research, it dawned on me that, well, if it's happening in adolescent and if there's this genetic programming for this reorganization at a time when historically we were to transfer from our families to creating our own families, then why wouldn't there be other programmed timing events later in life that would correlate with grandparenting or with moving to other roles within the tribe? And certainly if you look at the anthropological literature, what you find is that people at different stages of life certainly have accepted roles that are pretty much uniform around the world. Older people are responsible for complex problem solving, mediating religious issues, settling tribal disputes. There's a sort of demand that's placed on older brains in traditional cultures. And what I'm saying is most of the world still is like that. And even Western Europe and the United States were like that until about 150 years ago.
Yeah,
so our brains.
Go on.
Our brains are very much in our sort of agricultural and pre-agricultural past. Culture is evolving very quickly, but our brains are pretty much the same as they were 10,000 years ago.
So, Jerry, back to you and the existential issues. That might explain why we are so afraid now of aging, because as we age in this culture, we're no longer asked to contribute. We're no longer expected to contribute. We're expected to be on the receiving end.
Right, and there are two ways of looking at that. One is the one that Satchel Paige made famous when he said, you don't stop playing because you get old. You get old because you stop playing. And the other perspective is the notion, I think this links very well with what Lou was just saying, is that intimacy, social connection, may in fact be the antidote to both mortality and to brain deterioration. And so I think that old people are not necessarily put out to pasture, but they need to redefine what my life is about now. Who am I now that I'm 45 or 55 or 60 or 70?
You both agree that this population, our population, is going into uncharted territory. My parents lived well into their 80s, but they retired in their late 60s, and they retired the old-fashioned way. You know, they, you know, walked away from their jobs and careers, and that was it. And I've got no desire to do that over the next stage of my life, not unlike you, Jerry. So, Lou, you said in your book that, you know, as I said, we need a more balanced story of aging to guide us. So what would the more balanced story be?
Well, I think we suffer in this country from a prejudice against aging and a culture that's very oriented towards youth. So what happens is that the traditional values that have been placed in aging, the respect for elders, has kind of diminished to a great deal. And so people tend to flock to Florida, or they flock to Arizona. And what you have then is in these artificial communities, these retirement communities that get created, or you have people living in isolation. And I think so what we either have to do is stay connected to our families and remain a source or a resource to our families and have meaningful activities to contribute, or we have to develop new sources of meaning and new sources of connection and ways to contribute to the tribe, to the group, to society.
Ways.
There needs to be giving, I think, to optimize plasticity and well-being and wisdom.
Let's see.
And if I might jump in here,
sure.
It's the greatest opportunity at this age to have a perspective to make those kinds of contributions.
Yeah, that's critically important. We're gonna take a short break now, gentlemen, and we're gonna come back. We've got some people on the line who want to join the conversation. We're talking with Jerry Shapiro and Lou Cozzolino, both psychologists. We're talking about the autumn years of our lives and what that means to us baby boomers who are kind of creating our own way. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open. We're going to go to the phones right after our break. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child aged 12 to 25 that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the autumn years. And, boy, I'd like to give you the numbers, where that goes from where to where, but I really have no idea. I'll check with my guests when we bring them back on. My guests are Gerald Shapiro. He's a professor, chair of the Department of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara. He's written Finding Meaning, Facing Fears in the Autumn Years. Lou Cozzolino is a professor of psychology at the Graduate School of Education and Psychology at Pepperdine. And his books include The Healthy aging brain, sustaining attachment, attaining wisdom. And our number is 888-477-9499. Let me just find that number. I'm curious. Lou, let's start with you. What define the autumn years?
Oh, I have no idea.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think some people start as old souls very early in life, and other people never grow up. And so it's really hard to know.
Is it either or, old souls and never grow up? Can it be C, all of the above?
Probably. Yeah. Are you thinking of yourself?
I just had an identity crisis just now. Jerry,
I might add that so did I when he said that.
Yeah. All right. So you don't have an answer either, huh?
No.
All right.
I did define it, Dan, for the book as 45 to 65.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Right after midlife.
That's interesting. That's a younger generation, I think, than we're talking about on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Let's go to the phones. We've got Bobby on the line. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in a situation where I'm 58 years old, and I'm caring for my mother, who's 88 years old. And so I'm faced with the challenge of having to put my life on hold in order to take care of her. And I also have my son at home as well, who's 21 years old, and having to deal with those issues as well. So I was wondering, I kind of felt a little envious of the recordings I heard of people who said they felt so young. I kind of feel old right now, just in terms of the responsibilities that I have and also holding a full-time job.
Before I pass your question, comment over to our guest, I just, one observation. You said, I feel old right now, implying that perhaps that's a temporary situation.
I guess I'm an optimist, and I'm hoping that once my mother passes that things will change. But I don't wish her dead. we have an aging population, and she could live a long time. It's just sometimes the challenges of sort of being in that situation where you're in the autumn years, but yet having to care for an elderly person.
Lou, do you
trying?
Lou, do you want to weigh in on this for Bobby?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first thing that occurs to me, Bonnie, is it's what the research I've seen is that there's a lot to be gained in taking care of people who need you, parents, children, other people in the community. However, at a certain point, if you're not getting, your needs met, your own personal needs met, and if you're exhausted, then the negative, the opposite occurs. So I think this whole notion of putting your life on hold, which is where you started, is sort of caught my attention. And, what I would wish for you is to figure out some way, if possible, to get your life back going again and include what you're doing as part of your life.
What would that what would that look like, Lou?
Well, I mean, one thing I've seen often is that, of course, very good people who see responsibility and don't even question whether or not they would take care of parents or other people in need often forget to take care of themselves or forget to balance, balance their giving with their getting. And so if that happens, it's sort of like a bank account. You can keep writing checks, but eventually someone's got to make a deposit. And so that would be the first thing that I would check out. Like if you came to see me as a client, those are types of things I would discuss, self-care and your own, your vision about what it means to be both, to be so responsible to other people.
What's your reaction, Bobby, to what you're hearing from Lou about self-care?
I think that I agree. I think that self-care is very important, and I ride my bike. I'm very active, do yoga, that sort of thing. I just sometimes feel that, especially with a person with dementia, it's really, really difficult sometimes to actually eke out the time that you need. Mm-hmm. So my goal is is doing exactly what was just said. It's just actually being able to get there is the problem. I do have other people in my life that help support me with my mother. I have a 30-year-old daughter. My husband is very helpful as well. But I think sometimes it's just my feeling is that it's just a place that I have to be right now, and that I may not necessarily be able to achieve what I need to achieve. I accept the responsibility, but it just may be a time that I just have to wait and do as much as I can to nourish myself in the meantime.
Bobby, I wish you the best. Your position is, it's troubling. One human to another. I wish there was more joy in your life, and I sure wish more joy comes to your life, perhaps starting today. But, you've described your reality, and I'm sad to hear that it's so difficult for you at this moment in your life. Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks so much for calling. Jerry, this is a reality for so many people. These autumn years are, it's been called the sandwich years also.
Yeah, it's kind of like a multi-decker sandwich at this point.
Yeah, and it's difficult. It's sad. I mean, I, listening to Bobby and so many Bobbies out there, what can we say? What can we do as a culture, as friends, as families to help people live their lives more fully?
Well, I think what they say on the airlines when you get on about putting your own oxygen mask on first is the most essential piece. And I think Lou was saying something very similar when he was talking about the bank balance. You got to find a way to get enough help in that you can do something that's a growing edge. Now, part of the growing edge may be in finding meaning in caring for the older people, but part of it also is in self-nurturance. And I think Bobby is one of those people who's probably very responsible and very caring, and so she feels more on hold or more trapped by that. But the reality is that we can't be all things to others. We can barely be enough things to others and ourselves.
I want to come back to the issue of connection and how critical connection is. We've also got to consider the quality of that connection also. So if we're connected to family and the connection is kind of anxious or resentful or worrisome or guilt-laden, is that the kind of connection that's helpful for a brain?
It's really not. I mean, the quality of the relationship modulates whether or not we get beneficial effects from it, so neurochemically and just in general brain health. In fact, pressureful and critical relationships are actually far worse for us, than no relationships at all. Hmm. So it's, the quality of your relationship has to be taken into account. And there's wonderful research that shows, sort of people going into a surgical procedure, say, or some sort of a medical procedure where they're with their spouse and the spouse is holding their hand, and the amount of stress hormone reduction that occurs from their presence, and that level of reduction correlates with the reported quality of the relationship. Hmm. So it's having someone there, but it's also, like you're saying, that the nature and the quality of the relationship.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've had Catherine on the line. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
Yes, hi, Catherine.
You sound very distant to me.
No, I'm sorry. Can you hear me any better?
Yes. I wanted to know, I am 80 years old, and I stay connected to life in different ways. I live in a retirement community. Not everyone can, but here a man who is blind got the idea. We formed a group called Elders for the Future. And on Wednesday, a group of us are going to see our congressman in Washington about cutting military spending as they design the new budget. So then, as an individual, I have three grandsons that live locally. Yesterday, I took a 17-year-old grandson to see Lincoln, but we have lunch together, so the time we had together, I went into the internet and I got his Lincoln's background, a sketch, his quotes filled with wisdom, and his jokes. And it gives us something to talk about. And I connect myself to the future through this 17-year-old and enrich both our lives by looking at people who are wise. And I must tell you, I just bought a car. And when I bought it, I thought of George Burns when he said in his 90s, I don't buy green bananas. But I just bought a car at the age of 80.
Bless your heart. What great wisdom, what great vision you have. You are a wonderful mentor, certainly to me right now, but I'll bet to lots of other people in your life. Thank you so much for your call. So, Lou, it sounds like she could have written your book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would imagine that Catherine would be the type of woman who, if we were still in a tribal society of 75 or 100 individuals, that the children and the adolescents would probably naturally gravitate to her, and she would become a teacher, a really successful teacher, because of the compassion and warmth and care. And the fact that she's not sort of looking inward, she's actually seeing the future through the lives of the people around her. So she's a born teacher. And plus, she's stimulating her brain. She's going on the internet. She's learning new things. I hope she bought a convertible. I didn't ask her that. But I was thinking, you know, I hope she got something that's fast and the top goes down.
There's something else about Catherine and people like Catherine, and that is her belief in herself and her belief that she can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I would think, I'm not up on the literature here, but unfortunately I would think that is rare in an aging population, because it seems to me that self-esteem goes down as we age.
You know, that wasn't what I found. What I found was a lot of people had tremendous self-esteem and were really looking to the future. At least in the samples that I interviewed, people seemed in some ways more optimistic than they were in their 40s and 50s.
Wow, that's a very pleasant surprise. Let's take our short break, and when we come back, we've got lots more calls. And I also want to talk to you guys about sex and money. We're talking about the autumn years of our lives with Jerry Shapiro and Lou Cozzolino. Shapiro has written Finding Meaning, Facing Fears in the Autumn Years. Cozzolino wrote The Healthy Aging Brain. And our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the autumn years with psychologists and authors, Jerry Shapiro and Lou Cozzolino. Before we go to the phones, Jerry Lou, I just want to tell you that before the break, I said when we come back, we're going to be talking about sex and money. I'm looking at the production booth across from me, and you know, the engineer woke up and was intense curiosity, and my producer Jennifer looked at me with fear and trepidation, having no idea where I was going here. So let's talk about money first, and we'll start with you, Jerry. This is probably the last generation that's confident they will see Social Security, but at best, you know, what's it pay? $25,000, $30,000 a year, which puts someone near the poverty level. You wrote a chapter on this issue, and I was really troubled by the details of your findings. Many said they had no plans to retire, they couldn't afford it. 20% said they planned to retire from one career to a less stressful one for the benefits, and the majority assumed they would be living a more frugal life. That's pretty sad.
Yeah, you know, and money is the topic we won't talk about. I had a psychotherapy practice for many years, and people would talk about anything before they would talk about money. That was the big taboo. But money is an issue. We've gone from a defined benefit economy. You said your parents are retired in their 60s. I don't know if they had pensions, but many people of that generation did, and those are defined benefits. And then during the Reagan years, we switched over to a defined contribution sense, which has changed the landscape dramatically. And so now we're set in a situation where the money, you know, the money may not be there. And when you look at the total numbers, it's staggering. I mean, if you want to shake people up, basically, if you have $1 million in the bank, it throws off $50,000 a year.
Right. And who's got $1 million in the bank?
Well, very few. That's the point. Yeah. The average in the groups that I saw, the average was somewhere about $150,000, which if you're kind of direct costs, your immediate costs every year, your fixed income, fixed expenses, are $50,000, you got 3.5 years. And if we're going to live into our 80s and we're retiring in our 60s, though, that's, was it Clinton just said? The math doesn't work.
Right, right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Al on the line. Hi, Al.
Hi. There's a couple things now. To what he just said, I have gone back to work in the work. I'm 65. I've gone back to the workforce. I have certain issues, like when my late wife died, I paid off my house. But one thing that I've learned is that we don't need all this money that $50,000 a year for somebody who no longer has kids, and you know, et cetera. You know, sure, maybe you can't travel the world anymore, but things are not quite that. I mean, actually, what I originally called in for was that I find that life is very interesting at 65. That's what I've sort of learned, is that bad or good, it's always, I have no idea how things are going to turn out. And anyway, that's, as a life perspective, that just seems to make more sense. Well, than to worry about money at this point in time.
Yeah, I got to tell you, the nature of wisdom is to really know that we are clueless about what's coming around the corner and to somehow be okay about that. I mean, that's the nature of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Instead of making up stories about what's going to happen or the, you know, the pot of gold coming around the corner or the boogeyman coming around the corner, just to know that we don't know and how to somehow be comfortable with that. Al, thanks so much for your call and thanks for your perspective. Jerry, I want to get back to you. I promised to talk about sex, and you know, we're talking about connections here. Sexually transmitted diseases is increasing more for people over 50 than for people under 40. I read a an article entitled "Age is Not a Condom," but
right. But and it's like 4 to 5 times as much. It's not just. I mean, the increase is dramatic.
And why is that happening? It says something about the aging population. Also says something about the medical community and their attitude towards us.
Well, you know, the kids, the younger generations, were trained. They grew up in a post-AIDS, post-herpes world, and they were trained in safe sex, or at least as safe as it can get. The older population lived through that incredible 12 years that we had from the advent of the pill till the understanding of AIDS. And there was just about a dozen years in there. And we really believed in free love and free sex. And now these people are in their 60s and 70s, and that belief is still there. And they haven't been trained in the best thing to do. I think for most of the people of the autumn years, condoms were for birth control. Well, that you don't need anymore for most of us. But
yeah.
It's also the disease prevention. And I got to tell you, as you mentioned, doctors are loath to talk about sex, not as much as money, but they're loath to talk about sex with their aging clients.
Right.
Somehow people seem to think that when people hit a certain age, say the age of one's parents, sex is out of the question.
Right.
And, you know, we know that people are roughly interested in sex until at least 7 years postmortem.
That's all. Now you've got me afraid of dying all over again. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dick on the line. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. I want to relate a quote from, I believe, from George Burns. You can't stop getting older, but you don't have to get old. And my mother lived that to the fullest. She learned how to drive at the age of 72. Because she realized my father's driving was becoming problematic, and she wanted to continue the life that she had, which meant learning how to drive.
I think that's wonderful, and you know your mother's a great role model for you. Thanks for your call, Dick. This also though I want to come back to this. This comes back to the issue of identity and self. Lou, you said in your book that we're dependent on the feedback of the outer world to mark this passage of time. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it goes back to the opening piece that you had, which is that aging isn't something that we experience internally necessarily. It's I'm 59, and if I think about how old I feel, I'm just about 32. Which I'm told by my friends is quite mature for an inner age. But yeah, when I think back, somewhere between 27 and 32, perhaps. So this notion of self gets sort of organized really early on in life. And the things that, like, I noticed, I used to play squash every day, and then I blew out my knee, and then my eyes started going bad, and I kept trying to play. But I couldn't really play anymore. So it was like that was sort of an indication from the outside that age was happening. And I remember, you know, going out, say, in my 30s or 40s and seeing an attractive girl and her looking at me. And I could tell by the way she was looking at me is she thought of me as a father figure or in that generation. So there were just these little pieces of information that feed that to you, that let you know that that you're getting older. But I think internally we have, we have this sort of fixation, or we get stuck at a certain age, and we hold on to that. I remember my grandmother as when I was a young kid, her walking across the mirror and her staring at herself in the mirror, and I said, what are you looking at? She says, well, when I see myself in the mirror, I don't expect to see that. So I asked her, who did she think to see? So she went in and got a picture of herself from when she was about 20. And she said, this is the face I expect to see, not this one.
Mm.
And she pointed to herself. So that's what I was talking about as far as needing those external cues and paying attention to them and taking them seriously so as not to deny death too much.
We talked a lot about relationships to others, Lou. What about our relationship with ourselves as we age?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there are people with very good relationships with themselves at any age, and then there are those people that don't seem to know that they can have a relationship with themselves, or they don't appear on their own radar. But I think a wonderful thing, and I've talked about this with a number of friends recently who are in, sort of 65 and over, is that it's a time when there's a lot less distraction from things in the outer world as far as competing and, trying to figure out, who's got the most money and who's got the best looks and all of those things, where you can really start to reflect on what's most important, and you start to think about your legacy and what it is that you need and don't need. And so there's a real reevaluation of that, and I think becoming a good companion to yourself is an important piece of that.
Yeah, I very often ask people in my office, are you willing to be happy spending the rest of your life in relationship with you?
Mm-hmm.
And most people say no. I mean, that thought is frightening to them. That's heartbreaking because, when you go to bed every night, that's who you're with.
Right.
So that needs to be changed. We have to make that shift in the autumn years, because so many of us spend our youth and adulthood kind of beating ourselves up and judging ourselves harshly. That's a transition that's critical, kind of letting go of that and try to be kind towards the person we are.
And your question, Dan, may be exactly the kind of thing that clicks off in someone the beginnings of starting to examine their life in that way.
Yeah.
So it's a terrific question.
Approach yourself with a curious mind and an open, tender, loving heart. Let's talk to Eli. Eli is on the line.
Yep. Eli. Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb.
Sure.
For giving me the opportunity to say how wonderful it is that you are discussing this subject. I'm 86 years old. I work 12 hours a day and 7 days. I'm on 24/7 call. I feel that the problem is that we have to not only help our less fortunate relatives or strangers or whoever, which I try to do at every opportunity, but we have to encourage them. There's always something there to encourage them, as well as to be giving them some assistance. And my experience is that I took care of my mother until she was 93. And in my life, I had a business that went down. It was doing $100 million a year with hundreds of employees. Best thing that ever happened to me. I had to go out and work, and I'm still working. I'm 86. I've got a bypass, triple bypass. I've got a pacemaker. I've had a malignant section removed. I've got prostate cancer. I've got diabetes, and I feel that when I don't think about the fact that I'm 86, I feel like I'm 35, I feel like I'm in my early 40s.
Eli, I've got to tell you a story about my dad. That as he was aging, he used to say to me, "Danny, I'm ready to leave this vale of tears." And finally, I say, after trying to talk him out of it, which was silly, I said, "Are you really ready to go, Dad?" And he said, "Some days." And I said, "Tell me about those days." And he says, "Well, I get to thinking." He said, "My wife died." He said, "My daughter died. My sister had died 10 years earlier." He said, "I've got a son who's a quadriplegic and suffers every day." He said, "Those days, I'm ready to die." I said, "But Dad, those are true every day. Tell me about the other days." He says, "Well," He says, I'm not thinking about those things. I'm thinking about where I'm going to go for lunch. You know, it's all about what you're thinking about. Eli, thanks so much for your call and your perspective. Gentlemen, I grew up in the era of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and I still like both. Well, two of the three anyway. I'm taking different kinds of drugs. But I that's our generation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah, we weren't thinking about Lipitor back in the '60s though.
Or yeah. Viagra.
Yeah, so our generation really is vibrant, and we have got to take responsibility to kind of create a new path for ourselves, just like we did, you know, around Vietnam and civil rights and women's rights. You know, we took charge of the culture, and this is a culture that's ripe for learning new things about us and the aging process. I would think that's my deepest belief anyway, and I want to thank both of you from the bottom of my heart for doing the work you're doing and for taking the time to join us on the show.
You're welcome, Dan.
Jerry Shapiro is the professor of psychology. He's written Finding Meaning, Facing Fears in the Autumn Years. Lou Cozzolino is also professor of psychology at Pepperdine. He's written The Healthy Aging Brain, Sustaining Attachment, Attaining Wisdom. Next week on Voices, we're going to be talking about male survivors of sexual abuse. Well, you can comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. You can also download our shows there at WHYY or at iTunes. Well, the aforementioned engineer for today's show is Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafeman is our intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer par excellence. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, have a good week, my friends.
Tell Me More is next on WHYY. Devereaux